This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm with Professor James Dunlop, or I've known as Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hiya.
From the University of Edinburgh, and mm-hmm. You gave a very interesting talk today about submillimeter galaxies. Can you tell us more about it, like what's special about them and why we're interested in studying them?
Okay, so the strange word submillimeter means light with a wavelength is just a little bit under a millimeter in wavelength, as its name would imply. And we're interested in that because it carries information about star formation back from a time when the universe was very young. The reason it happens, well, young stars give out lots of blue ultraviolet light, but young stars also form in very dense, dusty, dark clouds. And so what happens is that most of that blue ultraviolet light gets absorbed by the dust. This is not dust like in our houses. This is interstellar grains of silicates and carbon. And then that dust re-emits the energy. It gets warmed up slightly, and then it re-emits the energy in what we call the far infrared, which is like heat, gentle warming. And then as that travels across the universe towards us, the universe expands and the light stretches a little bit more, and by the time it gets here, the light has grown in wavelength to just under a millimeter. And that's the stuff we are trying to detect.
So you're seeing the light from the stars or from the dust?
From the dust. It's been basically, it's the light that started in the stars, the energy that started in the stars, been reprocessed by the dust into very long wavelength light that's very, very faint and hard to detect.
So why is it interesting to look at dust? I mean, it's dust.
Well, some people are interested in the dust itself. Some people study interstellar dust to see if there's even the beginnings of the molecules of life in the interstellar medium. In my case, you know, I almost wish the dust wasn't in the way. We'd like to see the young stars. We're trying to work out the star formation history of the universe. And we're particularly interested in the time when star-forming galaxies were really violent in the early universe. So nowadays we live in a fairly peaceful time. We're lucky. Our Milky Way has got 100 billion stars in it, but it only forms stars at the rate of 2 or 3 suns per year. But 10 billion years ago, stars were forming in galaxies of 1,000 suns per year. And so we want to see when the bulk of the stars in the universe formed, and it's just our bad luck that they formed inside dust, and it's our good luck that we can now build telescopes to see this light.
How difficult is it to see those galaxies? Because you were saying that it's either galaxies like very far away or a long time ago, so it must be really hard to see.
It's really hard to see, so you have to build a big telescope, and it's made even harder that light at these wavelengths is absorbed by and emitted by water vapor in the atmosphere. So in a perfect world, you go into space, and there is a telescope called Herschel that's in space doing observations at similar wavelengths. But we also would like to use a giant telescope because, as you say, the objects are far away. We'd like to grab as much of the light as we could. And you can't put a giant telescope into space. It's just too expensive. So the telescope we're using is called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. It's half British, quarter Canadian, quarter the Netherlands. And it's not in space, but it's kind of as close as we can get to space. We've put it on one of the highest useful mountains in the world. It's on a volcano, extinct volcano, we hope, called Mauna Kea, which means white mountain in Hawaii. So that's at 14,000 feet, and when you go to use that, you have to be used to working at half oxygen. And so the hard work in seeing these galaxies is you need a big telescope, you want to be in a high, dry place, and you need to build a detector, a new kind of camera, which can see the submillimeter light. And that's a challenge because you have to cool it down to less than a degree above absolute zero, really low temperature, because otherwise the camera itself emits in the wavelength we're trying to see.
Okay, so that's really cold. I mean,
really cold. So it's a technical challenge.
That?
Well, you do it with a thing called a helium dilution refrigerator, which is a clever piece of cryogenic physics and engineering that helps you get everything cooled down to just a fraction above absolute zero. So this is like minus 270 degrees Celsius or centigrade. And so you have to do that because otherwise just the general glow of the surroundings swamps any signal that we're trying to get.
Okay. So remember you were saying in your talk that there's kind of two ways of seeing what those submillimeter galaxies could be. Either it could be some old version of what we could see now in like ultra-luminous galaxies, or it could be just one phase of the evolution. Is there any major indication on if it's one or the other?
So it's still kind of controversial. I guess that's one thing that makes it an interesting area of research. When these things were first discovered, with a previous version of a submillimeter camera built in the UK called Scuba, they were a bit of a surprise, and the only similar objects we knew about in the nearby universe were things called ULUGs, ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. And these seem to be very rare events triggered by violent collisions between galaxies, so-called mergers. And therefore the first instinct was that when we saw these things in the distant universe, that they were also driven by these rare mergers. But since then we've learned that back then, so this is like 10 billion years ago out of the 14 billion years available in the universe, we found that back then the whole universe is more active. So it's a bit like, instead of the surprise of finding the Loch Ness Monster nowadays, if you'd gone back to Jurassic Park times, it wouldn't have been particularly exceptional. And so the analogy is that maybe these things, although we think of them as really freakish events in the present day, quiet, peaceful universe, back then, the impression I have from the data we have is that they were just kind of at the extreme end of typical, so herds of Brontosaurus instead of the Loch Ness Monster.
I see. And how would they have evolved to like give the galaxies we have now?
Well, it's been a challenge for galaxy formation theories to explain these objects. So the interesting thing is they only seem to have lived for a relatively short period of time. Maybe the period of time you can see them is about a billion years in the history of the universe. So there seems to have been an era of maximum action. So if you go back further in time with the Big Bang, the universe had no objects in it. It was all hot gas, and then that cooled. And then there was so-called kind of cosmic dark ages. And then the first stars and galaxies started to form, and that's still an interesting area of work. And gradually they built up to produce these monsters, and then these monsters seem to have had some kind of final party where they made stars. And just after that, the interesting thing is they stopped it. And this is not something that's well understood. We now think either that the very act of this final frenzy of star formation maybe ejected a lot of the gas from the galaxies and therefore they turned themselves off. Or some people think that the black holes that maybe were in the centre of these galaxies blasted out the gas and cleared away the fuel and therefore they turned the galaxy off. So somehow...
How would they do that?
Well, they could do... There's various methods. I mean, there's an interesting issue of feedback in galaxy formation. So the same fuel that drives the growth of the black holes and the stars also produces radiation that can drive away the gas away from the galaxy. So they can stop themselves, basically. And that's not well understood yet.
Can I just ask, so how would a black hole emit anything to drive away the gas?
Well, the black hole itself isn't really what we're talking about emitting. We're talking about, as the gas tumbles down into the black hole, to actually get down into the black hole, it has to lose some energy. So if you think of our Earth orbits around the Sun quite safely, but if our Earth started to lose some energy, it would spiral into the Sun. So around black holes, for the gas to actually tumble down and eventually be sucked into the black hole, it has to lose energy sort of en route. So what people believe happens, and there's good observational evidence for this, is that as the gas spirals in, it loses that energy by heat, it radiates it away. So the black hole is powering the radiation because it's trying to tempt the gas to tumble down into it. But it's actually friction in the gas disk that is heating it up that's producing the radiation. And this makes black holes, if they're surrounded by fuel, shine brightly in the young universe. And we call these objects quasars, if it's the very big black holes that are powering them.
Oh, very cool. And what would be interesting to observe to like test those theories? What do you think would be the next step?
Well, the next step for this camera, Scuba 2, is having finally got through all the technical challenges and got it on the telescope, we want our money's worth in terms of telescope time. So we've been promised 3 years to do this big survey of the distant universe, and we're arguing hard for longer than that because it's been a major investment and we'd like to do a survey. The point is, if you just have small images, it's a bit like trying to take a political survey and only visiting a village in darkest Cheshire or something like that. So you would like a representative chunk of the country to get a good view of political opinion. And so we would like to image a representative chunk of the early universe to just see proper statistics and how common these objects were. And we also are using the Hubble Space Telescope to image the same regions of sky, so once we find these special objects in the submillimeter, we can look at whether they're spiral galaxies or interacting galaxies, see what drives these spectacular star formation events.
So you can actually see them in other wavelengths than submillimeter?
Absolutely. So astronomy is a pretty multi-frequency business these days. So these objects, we have radio imaging, we have X-ray imaging, and the X-rays can tell us if there's a black hole there, actually. And we have this, you know, the beautiful, elegant images you get from Hubble that allow us to actually see what these galaxies look like. So the submillimeter images themselves don't look very exciting. They just look like blobs. But these are special blobs, and then you can go to the Hubble, and you can look at them and say, right, well, we knew these were dusty galaxies. What's special about them in the optical?
Okay. Do we have any information or idea of why they're so special?
Well, they seem to be massive. They seem to be the biggest galaxies around at that time. That's pretty clear. And they also seem to be big, gas-rich, star-forming disks. And it does seem as if most of the star formation fueled in the early universe takes place in these spectacular big disk galaxies. I mean, our own Milky Way is a big disk galaxy, but it's not nearly as gas-rich as the ones in the early universe were.
So do you think it is kind of a mandatory step in the evolution of galaxy to go through this kind of massive star-forming?
It's certainly a mandatory step in the evolution of the most massive galaxies. So the objects we are seeing with Scuba 2 are the top end of the mass scale at this time. And the interesting thing is, in those days, the most massive galaxies seemed to be the most rapidly star-forming, most violent places in the universe. Nowadays, the most massive galaxies don't look like that at all. They're the most quiet, passive, giant, red, old elliptical galaxies. So somehow, something dramatic has happened to these objects. So we go from the most massive things being the most violent places in the universe to the most quiescent, old, and quiet places. And that may have something to do with this final frenzy of star formation and how they shut themselves down and were left as kind of passive old relics. So a bit like somebody who had a really wild youth and then did nothing thereafter for the rest of their life, sadly.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
A pleasure to speak to you again, Melanie.